Hello and welcome to this podcast from the BBC World Service. Please let us know what you think and tell other people about us on social media. Podcasts from the BBC World Service are supported by advertising.
If you're hearing this, you're probably already listening to BBC's award-winning news podcasts. But did you know that you can listen to them without ads? Get current affairs podcasts like Global News, Americast and The Global Story, plus other great BBC podcasts from history to comedy to true crime, all ad-free. Simply subscribe to BBC Podcast Premium on Apple Podcasts or listen to Amazon Music with a Prime membership. Spend less time on ads and more time with BBC Podcasts.
Hello and welcome to NewsHour from the BBC World Service, coming to you live from London. I'm Sean Lay. It's more than a week since Israeli Defence Forces, the IDF, started operations inside the sprawling Jabalia refugee camp in northern Gaza. Now, airstrikes and artillery fire are reported to have killed dozens of people there. There are also reports that 11 people were killed in an attack on a single house in the smaller, very crowded Al-Makazi camp in central Gaza. Both are run by the UN agency UNRWA. We'll hear from its Gaza director shortly. But first, our correspondent Jonah Fisher is in Jerusalem. What more can he tell us about the attack on Jabalia?
From what we were told by the Hamas-run health authorities yesterday evening, there was either shelling or some sort of strike on some residential buildings. 33 people are, according to their reporting, dead, 21 of them women, and they say that possibly as many as 50 people are dead, with 85 people injured. At the same time, some pretty gruesome footage has emerged on social media of one of the local hospitals with more than a dozen bodies on the floor wrapped in either shrouds or in blankets. And one of the directors of that hospital, Al Awda Hospital, has been saying that effectively that hospital is overwhelmed, that everyone who's been brought in injured is having to be treated on the floor and they are struggling to cope. So this morning, we've been in touch with several other hospitals in Jabalia and near Jabalia, and they are talking about being surrounded by the Israeli military, about coming under fire. One, the Indonesian hospital, who we'd just been in touch with a short while ago, said that two patients had died this morning due to power being cut off at that hospital, meaning that the oxygen was no longer getting through. So a pretty bleak picture, really, of what life is like at the moment in that part of northern Gaza.
So that's in Gaza. Meanwhile, in Israel, we have reports of a drone apparently targeting a property that belongs to the Prime Minister of Israel, Benjamin Netanyahu.
That's right. What we know from the Israeli Defence Force is that three drones crossed from southern Lebanon into Israeli airspace this morning. Two of those drones were shot down, but one of them managed to make the quite long journey. It's about 50 kilometres from the Lebanese border to Caesarea, which is where Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has a private residence there. And it's not entirely clear at this point where it had its impact, but somewhere around his residence, that drone came down. And we've had a statement from the Prime Minister's office this morning making it clear that that Netanyahu was not there or his wife and that no one was injured. But it is striking that, within the context of an air defence for Israel that generally works very well against things like rockets, which have a predictable path, this is becoming an increasingly regular thing, that a drone, and we know they're almost all Iranian-built drones, is getting through, and in this case, getting all the way to, obviously, quite a sensitive location.
The Israeli security services quoted as describing it as a very serious security failure and launching an investigation.
Well, yeah, and it's not the first time. Just in the last week, we had another drone coming south and managing to hit an army base with serious casualties on that one occasion. So, the way these drones fly, the way they go at low altitudes, they go at relatively slow speed, so they're harder actually for fighter jets to shoot down. They are posing a persistent problem for Israel in terms of trying to defend its airspace. And I think at the moment, serious discussions are being had about what better they can do and how they can approach this better, because it's believed that Hezbollah in southern Lebanon have quite a significant stock of weapons and ammunition, including plenty of these drones from Iran.
Jonah Fisher in Jerusalem. The camps in Gaza are all run by the UN Refugee Agency for Palestinians, known as UNRWA. I've been speaking to its Gaza director, Sam Rose. He's currently in Khan Yunis in the south of the Strip. How would he describe the reports he's getting from Jabalia right now?
The situation in Jabalia is awful. I mean, it is absolutely catastrophic. The siege of the camp and part of the surrounding area has been going on now for almost 2 weeks. Tens of thousands of people trapped inside. We're hearing reports from some of our staff on the ground, by all accounts, and we're not able to verify this. Several hundred people have been killed. And if the numbers of dead are at 300, 400, then we would have to estimate that the injuries are in the thousands. I mean, people with nothing and really with nowhere to go, they're being ordered to leave, but there's nowhere for them to go because it's not safe for any of them to move, given the intensity of the fighting and the bombardment that they're under. We haven't been able to get any supplies into the area for days. Now, small amounts of aid have started coming in to northern Gaza, but they're not getting in to Jabalia. So absolutely desperate conditions.
We had a statement from the Civil Defence Agency in Gaza a little earlier, putting casualty figures overnight in double figures. But you're talking about a significantly larger number than that. Are you talking over the 2 week period?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm talking over the past 2 weeks. But every morning we're waking up and we're hearing of other incidents where 20, 30 people have been killed, bombardments overnight that led to the deaths we're seeing reported of 33 people, for example. But no, since the start of this phase of the operation, numbers of dead in the several hundreds is what we're hearing.
An Israeli cabinet minister told NewsHour on Friday that it had allowed civilians to flee and the blockade now imposed was because the people still in there are Hamas fighters trying to restore their military capability.
Do you want my comments on that?
Yes, I do, yeah.
I mean, look, we're not able to get up there. We don't know precisely what is going on. What we're hearing is people are not able to flee because of the intensity of the fighting. They are being ordered out. There's nowhere to go. Or else many of them, they're not able to leave. I mean, there are 300 people in hospital in northern Gaza, dozens of them on ventilators and intensive care. There are the sick, there are the elderly. There are people up there who fled in 1948 thinking that they'd be able to go back to their homes in a few days, and here they are now. So there's a real resonance about the idea of fleeing. And look, forced displacement is illegal under international law. Parties to conflict are required. And when I say parties to the conflicts, I mean here Israel and Hamas and other groups operating on the ground here. They're absolutely required and obliged under international law to protect civilians, to protect civilian infrastructure, to take necessary precautions. And as we continue to say on this, two wrongs do not make a right. What we are concerned for here is the well-being and the lives of the civilian population who are amongst the most vulnerable people on the planet right now. And all this shows us that there's no military solution to any of this. This has been going on now for over a year. The horror, the torture that these people are going through is unimaginable. The vast majority of Jabalia, even before this operation started, had been destroyed. We dread to think what it looks like now. We have to assume almost every building now is in ruins. So when people are sheltering, they're sheltering amid the rubble of bombed out buildings. They're darting from one to another to try and get some modicum of safety in between the gunfire and the tank shells.
That's Sam Rose from the UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees, UNRWA. Well, Lieutenant Colonel Jonathan Comricus is a spokesman for the Israeli Defence Forces. Colonel Comricus, thank you very much for talking to us on NewsHour. What can you tell us about the overnight attacks in Jabalia?
Yes, I've been listening. Thank you for having me. Good day to you. I've been listening with lots of attention to the previous speakers. And one thing that's very important in terms of context, which I think will put many things in place, is that there is significant Hamas military activity in Jabalia. That is the reason why the IDF is operating there. Israeli troops have encountered IEDs. They have engaged Hamas operatives at close ranges all over Jabalia. And they are engaged in combat. And that's really missing from reporting. And you could think that if you'd listen to the last two speakers, that the IDF are there on some wanton mission of aggression. They're there because Hamas is there and is posing a threat against Israelis, and that's why IDF has moved in.
Let's talk about the specific. You can't confirm this figure of 33 dead overnight. So just to be clear, you at this stage you can't confirm that. Is that correct?
No, I can't. Fine. Unfortunately, we're looking into it.
Right.
Now, as I heard it, I've asked for it to be confirmed.
Yeah, thank you very much, and maybe we'll hear about that a little later. But just let's talk then more broadly about the operation in Jabalia, and this is important, isn't it? Because under international law, you are under obligation to ensure civilians get out, but even if they don't get out, you have to take certain precautions. And the argument that UNRWA is saying is that because effectively they're walking out into a kind of into a military operation in order to get out to a safe area, many won't leave. And that doesn't remove your obligation, does it, to them?
No. Let's unpack that for a second. And when our listeners hear UNRWA, what do we know about UNRWA? From an Israeli perspective, UNRWA is the money laundering front of Hamas.
I take the argument you're making on that, but that is not the question I asked you. It's about civilians.
It's not about UNRWA itself,
or the people who work for UNRWA. It's about civilians.
Yes, sir. I will answer about our obligations, but I just want to put things here from an Israeli perspective. When someone from UNRWA speaks, I hear a Westerner speaking in Western language, but it is the talking points of Hamas. It is a facade for Hamas, and they are there aiding, abetting, providing cover and money laundering and material support for Hamas. So when they say things, I don't take it with a lot of legitimacy.
Right,
now, speaking about commitment.
Yes, please.
Yes,
thank you.
That is my
fine. Thank you. Now to the question.
Regarding obligations, definitely. And Israeli troops, I just spoke with one of the commanders on the ground, constantly brief soldiers on the ground to be aware of their obligation under international law only to engage military combatants, to use distinction between combatant and non-combatant, to use proportionality in the use of force so that there's a minimal risk for hitting civilians. Israeli troops continue to do that. I know that the results may not be perfect, and that is sad and regrettable, but the reason for civilians getting killed is because Hamas is fighting from where the civilians are, and they're using them as human shields.
What about the other aspect of this? This is one raised by the British Prime Minister speaking in Germany on Friday after he had held a meeting with Presidents Biden and Macron and with Chancellor Scholz, so the leaders of the US, Germany and France and the UK, all of whom are allies, long-standing allies of Israel. And Mr. Sir Keir Starmer was saying, we don't want any more excuses from the Israelis over the provision of aid and humanitarian help for civilians in northern Gaza.
Yeah, I take that point. And I think that there have been difficulties in delivering aid over the month, the end of September and during October. According to the numbers that I have, there is a significant and sincere effort by the IDF with the help of UN and private organizations to flood northern Gaza with aid. More is coming in. We are aware that even more needs to be done. The biggest obstacle that we're facing is the issue of final distribution. And that is where we're struggling now, but we are aware of the need.
We are going to have to leave it there. Forgive me for that. We are out of time. This is NewsHour from the BBC World Service. You're listening to the BBC World Service, and this is NewsHour. Coming up, we meet the director of a new drama about time spent by the Canadian singer Leonard Cohen living on the Greek island of Hydra.
We got the opportunity to shoot on some of the actual locations so that, for instance, the first apartment that Leonard sleeps in when he arrives on the island, for Alex Wolff, who plays Leonard, is the actual apartment he slept in when he arrived on the island.
That's in just under 30 minutes' time. Our main headlines this hour, the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said nothing will deter him after Hezbollah targeted his home with a drone from Lebanon. And there's been a let-up in Israel's offensive against Hamas in Gaza, with dozens of Palestinians reported killed in the past 24 hours. This is Sean Lay with NewsHour, live from the BBC in London. Now, there is rightfully a great deal of focus, in particular in France and the UK, on the number of people dying in attempts to cross the narrow strip of water which separates the two countries as they try to illegally land in Britain, often in wholly inadequate dinghies. There are, though, also legal battles taking place in French courts, where those alleged to be running the smuggling operations are being brought to justice. Andrew Harding has been in the city of Lille in northern France to follow the biggest cross-channel human trafficking case of recent years.
I'm walking through the cobbled streets of Lille, a big city in northern France, heading to the courthouse here, where a big trial is just getting underway. 21 alleged people smugglers, one big gang accused of transporting people illegally from Europe across the channel to the UK. The accused, mostly Iraqi Kurds, there's one French woman, one Polish man. We're only about an hour's drive here from the coast and the beaches where the smugglers launch their boats. Okay, we're going into the courtroom now. Some of the accused are now being brought in handcuffs, escorted by a big crowd of French police in their body armour, pistols at their side. This is the biggest cross-channel smuggling case to come to trial. The prosecution is asking for the ringleader to get 15 years in prison. But will that act as a deterrent?
There's a big scrum of activity as lawyers and translators consult with some of the accused before the proceedings get underway, and at which point we will have to stop our recording.
In court, the prosecution calls the accused merchants of death, a callous gang making 60,000 euros in profit from each overloaded boat that it launched into the channel. We weren't allowed to talk to those leading this case, but we did get a rare interview with a different French prosecutor, head of the Regional Court of Appeal, Pascal Marconville, a man with huge experience in prosecuting smugglers.
En matière d'immigration clandestine, en tout cas, ce qu'on est confronté, moi, je dis toujours aux policiers, c'est comme aux échecs, ils ont les bras avant d'aller voir.
It's like chess, and the smugglers are always one step ahead of us. We must adapt. These days, the smugglers operate just like drug gangs. The action taken by French police, supported by investigative judges, is designed not only to thwart the smugglers, but to make their operations so expensive that they lose their appeal.
A sensible strategy, perhaps, but is it working?
During a break in the trial, we've come to a nearby cafe to talk to one of the defence lawyers.
So I'm sitting with Kamel Abbas.
Yes, my name is Kamel Abbas, and I'm a French lawyer from Lille Bar Association.
And you're defending some of these alleged smugglers?
Exactly. Exactly.
You've been covering these sort of cases for a long time.
Oui, j'ai eu plusieurs dossiers de migrants, effectivement.
And how have things changed over the years? And the punishment that the state's demanding?
Les peines sont beaucoup plus lourdes. Ça, c'est une évidence.
The sentences have become a lot heavier. That's clear, he says. 15 years for some. Before that, they were just set free. So the legal framework is getting much tougher, and I think it will continue to do so.
Je pense qu'elle va encore durcir.
And do you think that's sensible? Do you think that will help discourage people from getting involved in smuggling?
Non. Malheureusement, il n'y a rien qui décourage les gens.
No. There are some who put money above all things. So for them, prison sentences are just a bump in the road.
You sound quite pessimistic about this.
Pour que ça s'arrête, oui.
That all this will stop? Yes, I am.
A case like this involves Belgium, Holland, oui. Germany,
Greece,
and France.
Oui.
Are you seeing better coordination, cooperation?
Oui, 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 oui. Les parquets
européens. Yes, Abbas says. European prosecutors are cooperating well.
From your experience, do the big fish, the real powerful smugglers, ever get caught?
Ils sont chez vous en Angleterre et en Irak.
You're saying they're in England and or in Iraq.
Ils sont chez vous, oui.
You're saying that if you really want to tackle this industry, you've got to go after the bosses. And so he's saying the British authorities should be looking closely in the UK for the ringleaders, because if you want the pyramid to fall, you have to start with the top.
As for this trial, so big it's generated 67 tons of paperwork, it's due to end with verdicts and sentencing in early November.
Andrew Harding reporting from Lille in northern France. Hot sauce is a food fad that seems here to stay. Celebrities are marketing their own recipes. There's a hit show online in which famous people are interviewed as they sample ever hotter condiments. Now, I have a confession to make. I'm a hot sauce virgin, or at least I was, until Jen Ferguson of online retailer Hot Burns and Black came into the studio with a selection of her wares. And I asked her first, has she seen evidence that hot sauces are, well, hot?
Last year saw 94% sales increase for hot sauces. Christmas time was 150% up on 2022. And this year shows no sign of slowing either. We're looking at 35%, I think, so far. So, yeah, it's going a bit crazy.
Now, you've brought in three bottles for me to try. This one first is called Deptford. Is this a mild one? I hope it's a mild one to start with.
I think my palate's probably a little bit jaded. For me, it's not that mild. Sorry, not that hot, but you can be the judge of that.
Right, hang on. It's a sort of orangey colour. Hang on a second. We put it on a crisp. No, that's hot. That's hot. It's not too hot, you're right. It's not too hot.
It's not too hot, and I think the chilies that it uses, it's yellow habaneros, so the heat is immediate, but it kind of subsides quite quickly. And you've got a lot of fruit in there as well. So you've got passion fruit, you've got pineapple, you've got mango, and the sweetness tempers the heat a wee bit. So it's a kind of quite horribly named trend called swicy, a nasty portmanteau of sweet and spicy. So I didn't make that up.
Now, this is Jock's hot sauce. I'm tempted to ask who Jock is, but this is not as mild. This is a darker colour. I mean, one quick thing I ask you while I try this one is, there's a risk, isn't there, with hot sauces that we're just losing our palate for flavours?
Possibly. I think we sell a lot of super hot sauces, but I think for the most part, people...
Blimey. Sorry.
I'm enjoying
it. Carry on.
Yeah, I think for the most part, people want sauces that are full of flavour. Medium heat, that they're not going to be destroyed after a couple of drops. They want something they can sling over their meals, something that's versatile, adding a little bit of flavour.
I'm going to need a slurp of water at this point, Jen. Hang on. Ooh. Let me say about that one that's still in the back of my throat. And so I'm slightly hesitant with this last one because you did warn me. There's a scale for heat. This last one, which is called Experience with a capital X, where is it on the scale of heat?
So this one sits at number 10. If you've ever seen the YouTube series Hot Ones, where celebrities eat 10 sauces ranging in heat, this is the last one.
This is
it's called The Last Dab, and this is a lot of sauce you're putting on that crisp there, Sean. So it's called The Last Dab, and it may be the last thing we ever hear from Sean.
You said there's a kind of 1,000, and that's 2 million on this scale.
That is 2 million plus.
Oh, I think this is the one. I may still be tasting this at breakfast tomorrow. Jen, last word. Do you think the celebrities, are they making a difference to these sales?
I think the Hot Ones show certainly is. Whether Brooklyn Beckham is going to have a career in hot sauce making, I don't know.
Jen Ferguson there, and I have to say, thankfully we recorded that last night, took a slurp of milk before I started to feel better.
If you're hearing this, you're probably already listening to BBC's award-winning news podcasts. But did you know that you can listen to them without ads? Get current affairs podcasts like Global News, Americast and The Global Story, plus other great BBC podcasts from history to comedy to true crime, all ad-free. Simply subscribe to BBC Podcast Premium on Apple Podcasts or listen to Amazon Music with a Prime membership. Spend less time on ads and more time with BBC Podcasts.
Welcome back to NewsHour. In the days when news travelled slowly rather than simultaneously around the world, some Italian communities would rely on cantastori, wandering story singers known by some as troubadours. They'd write and perform songs about everyday struggles or about shocking events. Adriana Urbano travelled to Sicily to meet one of the country's last cantastori.
Signore! This is Ballarò, one of Italy's oldest markets, right in the centre of Palermo, Sicily's capital city. Here, sellers flog fruit juice,
prego ragazzi, arancia un euro,
or invite you to sample street food.
Prova la panella.
But there is one voice you will no longer find, that of the cantastorie, story singers, who would travel around performing their own songs about what was going on in the world. Among them is Nono Salamone, one of the last cantastorie left. He is described as a living treasure by the region's official heritage register. To meet him, I travel to the village of Sutera, over 60 miles into Sicily's rural heartland. At 79, he has seen the tradition evolve.
The first modern cantastorie was likely Ciccio Busacca, who travelled all the way to central Italy. He would sit on the top of his car, prop up the boards with pictures illustrating the story, and he would sing. I have always sung stories of people who've suffered from hunger or other issues, people's pain. There's a story I wrote about a teenager who I knew in real life.
Rosa viva 15 anni, era figlia di un dottore, era bella veramente.
Rosa falls pregnant and is kicked out of her home. She finds people who force her on the streets as a prostitute and lead her to drugs. She dies.
Ma Rosa, 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 tu ne vai. Ma Rosa, 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 resta qua.
The cantastorie also keep history alive. Take The Train of the Sun, Lo Treno dello Sole, written by poet Ignazio Buttitta.
It's the Marcinelli tragedy. A wife learns many Italians have died in a mine in Belgium, including her husband.
Today, his performances are rare and limited to local festivals, but the news is still fueling his defining mission as a cantastorie, pointing the finger at injustice. We part ways with the story of a young football fan terrified by bombings.
It's the story of a child who crosses the Mediterranean in a dinghy because of so-called humanitarian bombs.
Adriana Urbano reporting for NewsHour. You're listening to NewsHour from the BBC with me, Sean Lay. That North Korea has been supplying weapons to support Russia in its war with Ukraine has been known for some time, but the release of two videos on social media overnight provides the first visual evidence that it may actually be supplying soldiers too. It follows South Korea's announcement yesterday that 12,000 troops have gone from North Korea to Russia. Well, Sung Yoon Lee from the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars in Washington, D.C., joins us now from South Korea. Sung Yoon Lee, thank you for talking to the World Service and NewsHour. What do we know about this, and should we be surprised by this development?
I don't think we should be surprised. What North Korea enjoys vis-a-vis democracies around the world is not only a term for life for the supposedly great leader, but also millions of artillery shells and missiles which have found their way to Ukraine. We know that for a fact. But also an inexhaustible supply of expendable human lives. North Korea is the only industrialized, urbanized, literate country in world history to have undergone a nationwide famine. And according to the UN, each year, North Korea has one of the most serious, number three or number four in the world, food insecurity, or the highest prevalence of undernourishment among the population. So this does not bode well in that 10,000, 20,000 battle deaths for North Korea, for the leader, it's no big deal. So it's a growing concern for, of course, Ukraine, but also Ukraine supporters around the world.
Now, among the evidence, as South Korea puts it, that's been released is photographs of a man, it says, is Kim Jong-sik, first vice director of the munitions industry department, seen in a photo of Kim Jong-un, but also seen in a photograph with a apparently Russian soldier and himself dressed in the similar combat gear, we are told, on the front line. That doesn't necessarily mean, though, he's there to fight as a soldier, does it? And that might be something that perhaps some outsiders would be a bit sceptical of about this information.
Sure, but that does credence to the view out there that North Korea is committed to sending combat troops. And you mentioned the two videos of North Korean soldiers being outfitted in Russian Far East. I've watched both, and you can hear North Korean, that is North Korean accent and intonation being spoken. So that's unmistakably North Korean, the Korean language, the northern version being spoken. And the troops are elite, the most elite troops in North Korea. In the North Korean army, we're told, but they look gaunt, they look undernourished, very short. Other non-Asians, Russians and others, are fully one head taller than the North Koreans. That doesn't mean that we should take them lightly, yes. But I think there's an opportunity for Ukraine and allies to wage some political warfare of their own and try to goad, incite the North Koreans to defect. Now, that would hurt now, the infallible, supposedly, North Korean leader.
Let me ask you finally, how do you think this information newly released might affect the meeting of G7 defense ministers in Naples, Italy today?
Well, I don't think any major European leader has come out and made a statement on this unnerving development, but in due course, of course, they will. But again, what North Korea is doing is psychological warfare vis-a-vis Ukraine and its sponsors, sowing the seeds of long-term gnawing anxiety and concern. Where does this lead? Will Russia actually supply North Korea with nuclear-powered submarine technology and so on? So we don't know yet, but I don't think we're completely helpless. I think democracies around the world have to band together and address this issue.
Sung-Yun Lee from the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars, joining us from South Korea. Thank you very much. Just an apologies if you're listening to that. We had some breakup on the line, but I think it was clear what Mr. Lee was saying. Now, Cubans are experiencing a nationwide blackout after the country's main energy plant failed, knocking out electricity to around 10 million people. The government's declared an emergency, suspending all the non-essential services it supplies, including closing schools. But it's also blamed the decades-long US embargo for preventing replacement parts from reaching the island. Miriam Leva is a human rights activist based in Cuba's capital, Havana.
Normally, it's 8-12 hours, but in Havana it's less, always around 4 hours maybe. But this is a very unique and incredible situation. The president posted a tweet saying that the prime minister would speak yesterday, and well, those who have internet, that is very difficult here, heard about it, and then the television announced it, and then they announced that there were some technical problems and the prime minister would speak. And finally, at 10:30, we had the prime minister with two executives from the electricity unit talking. And he simply said that there were problems with the electricity and that this would be solved. And they said it was problems with the electric plants and of course, because of the American embargo and so on as usual, and that they were having also problems with the fuel for the auxiliary motors that they have. And that, but this would be solved. Today we learned that problem was in the whole country. I think they have to do something, but I don't know when they're going to resolve this. Because if they don't have any money to pay for a fuel, it's said that it's a problem with the electricity plants. They don't have any backup, let's say. So I don't know how they're going to solve this. People are suffering, but the lack of electricity there is a great lack of food in Cuba. So people usually move around trying to grab something. And those who have some money to pay for the high prices because there is a great inflation. But anyway, the situation for the Cuban people is very, very difficult. And those who don't receive any remittances from abroad or don't have any means, you know, to sell something, or the wages are very low. There are no products. If the government doesn't have anything to export, if they close the factories as they have been doing, what is going to happen? Because the government always tries to supply energy, electric energy for the population, so everybody, you know, keep quiet. But in this moment, if one of the main things they have always done is to close the production, then how the country is going to survive?
Miriam Leyva in Havana. And the government earlier said it was restarting the power plant, but we've just heard that it's failed for a second time. Two songs by the late Leonard Cohen illustrate his passion for immortalising the women he saw as the most beautiful. One is Bird on the Wire, the other, So Long Marianne, about Marianne Hélène, whom he met in 1960 on the Greek island of Hydra. She'd already been married and had a son. A new series on British television depicts both that relationship and the inspiration behind much of Cohen's best-known music. Here's the writer and director of the series, Øystein Carlsson.
Leonard Cohen.
I see you've gone and changed your name again.
So Long Marianne, I think, is a story about being 22, 23 years old, leaving home for the first time and going into the world totally without the safety net and trying to find your voice. We got the opportunity to shoot on some of the actual locations so that, for instance, the first apartment that Leonard sleeps in when he arrives on the island, for Alex Wolff, who plays Leonard, is the actual apartment he slept in when he arrived on the island. And that, of course, makes it both a little more scary because you feel even more that you have to be true to what happened, but also it gives you a feeling of being in the presence of their spirit somehow, because you see exactly what they saw when you open the curtains.
Suzanne takes you down to her place near the river.
So what brings you to Hydra, Leonard?
Oh, escaping from London.
Wow. So did we.
The great thing about Hydra, of course, is time has more or less stood still since 1960, because when we first got there, we thought that we would have to paint out neon signs and, you know, all of those modern things, but nothing like that has happened, and it looks like it did then, and it is really spectacularly beautiful, and I think everyone felt that we were doing something special.
And you want to travel with her, and you want to travel blind.
The thing that we didn't think about when we decided to shoot there is that the island has no cars. But here we had like a lightning donkey and a camera donkey, and it was like this caravan of donkeys going up the hill with our gear. It became very low key, and even though we have like a vast ensemble of great actors who are used to totally different conditions than this, then everyone was sort of on the same level, and it was a great experience.
Come over to the window, my little dog.
So Long Marianne, of course, is a beautiful song, which actually first had the title Hello Marianne, but then in the recording studio turned into So Long Marianne, which I think gives us more depth and several more layers.
Before I let you take me home.
Marianne had run away to Hydra with a Norwegian author, Axel Jensen, and he dumped her when she had a four-month-old kid. And that's when sort of Leonard rescues her and they become a couple. And then 9 years later, she rescues him out of Chelsea Hotel when he's totally strung out and at rock bottom. So it has a bookend of people needing each other in both ends of it. And of course, they stayed friends their whole lives. And the most famous thing, of course, is the letter that she receives on her deathbed when he says, "I'm not far behind you." A lot of people have very different ways into the work of Leonard Cohen. I myself started really, really early. I was one of those youths that wanted to be dark and mysterious in the corner. and usually ended up sitting at the kitchen at parties and talking to the girls that were heartbroken. Leonard was like a perfect fit for the 17, 18-year-old me. But I've lived with Leonard my whole life. And you can, of course, say it's a really stupid idea for a guy that doesn't have English as his first language to try to write the voice of Leonard Cohen. And I must say, it's the hardest thing I've ever written. Let's hope that you guys who are masters of the English language don't chop me off at the knees.
Øystein Carlsen, as if we would. He's the writer-director of the TV series So Long, Marianne. You are listening to the BBC World Service, and this is NewsHour. Do stay with us. This is Sean Lay with NewsHour, live from the BBC World Service. With fewer than 3 weeks to go until the election of Joe Biden's successor as US president, the contest is displaying ever more signs of going down to the wire. Statistically inseparable from one another, Kamala Harris and Donald Trump will know how dependent their fate is on the relatively small number of undecided voters in a handful of marginal states. I've been talking to two of them. Cameron Llewellyn works in IT in Georgia. He's a father of three, an African-American who voted Trump in 2016, Biden in 2020. But first, Lynn Kelleher, a realtor, that she sells property in Pennsylvania. She's a mum of two, is white. She voted Trump in 2016, but supported a third party candidate in 2020. She just cannot, though, bring herself to vote Trump this time.
I've always kind of held Republican ideals as kind of in line with my thinking. Donald Trump, I despise him. I just don't know that I can vote for that man.
So for those kind of prominent Republicans, people like Dick Cheney, the former vice president, who said they're going to vote for Kamala Harris because they are so revolted by Donald Trump, kind of intellectually, you can't make that jump.
The fact that so many people in his party have come out against him, people who worked with him, weighs heavily. And at this point, I am kind of leaning more towards Kamala, but I just don't know that I can make that leap. I think she's far more liberal than she lets on to be. The border policy is important to me. Her record on that is abysmal. And, you know, the fact that her running mate has and she have advocated for providing illegal immigrants opportunities that should be reserved for citizens, like driver's licenses and all that kind of stuff. I just don't know.
Okay, let me bring in Cameron Llewellyn there, who is in Georgia, which is a little bit close to the border. But before we talk about the border question, Cameron, I'm fascinated by your journey. You did vote for Donald Trump in 2016, but as much as anything, that was a protest vote against the way the Democrats had treated Bernie Sanders.
That's right. I am in favor of a meritocracy. I do believe that you actually need to earn the right to govern. Specifically in that election, what I saw is that Bernie Sanders was sort of railroaded. And so my vote in 2016 was as much against the sort of creeping coronation of Hillary as it was a hope that Bernie Sanders would be and represent a new, fresh path forward for the country.
Right. So if Hillary Clinton had a coronation, you'd have to say that kind of even more the case with Kamala Harris.
Yeah, you beat me to it. I understand that it was incredible circumstances that caused Joe Biden to step down. The American public deserved a chance to decide who was going to be the Democratic nominee. And the votes that were cast were for Joe Biden, not for Kamala Harris. And so since we just passed that off, there's a sense that she didn't actually do anything to earn the nomination. And I think you can see that in the most recent outreach, specifically to African-American men, because it seems like it's been pandering toward a demographic that just hasn't really shown up for her.
And I think you say that as an African-American man yourself.
I do. And in fact, I was saying it as far back as when she received it. I said, okay, that if that's what she's going to do, well, you're going to have problems with a voting base that has absolutely no reason to vote for you other than you're saying, hey, I'm black. That's not the way that things should be.
Even allowing for that, it is hard to see how that would make you vote Donald Trump this year, given that you rejected Trump 4 years ago by voting for Joe Biden, Cameron.
Yeah, I'm a little bit of the flip of Lynn, right? I had voted Democratic most of my life. But American exceptionalism is this idea that the American experiment is based on ideas that we are special in the world, and that in order to maintain that special place in the world, we have got to be investing in our own security, as Lynn said, jobs, trying to do that in a way that is egalitarian. Right. And we no longer had that, at least prior to Donald Trump. The irony is that the person that they believe will bring it in is, you know, the only president that's been indicted and had, you know, this many things, including January 6th.
Lynn Kelleher, let me go back to you. What about the issue that a lot of people have said might drive undecided voters into the Harris camp, or at least certainly away from Donald Trump, and that is the question of abortion?
I support the woman's right to choose, but I will be honest and say that while it is really important, it's probably number four in my top three issues, which are the border, the economy, foreign policy. Again, that's another thing that just makes it so difficult for me. I don't think Kamala has the presence or the experience to guide us out of what's become, you know, a world on fire. Mm-hmm. And yet Donald Trump thumps his chest and just thinks that because he says something, it's going to be true, and certainly doesn't understand the nuances of foreign policy.
Cameron Llewellyn, there will be some people listening to this who, having heard what you said about Donald Trump, having heard also what you the reservations you have about the way the Democrats chose their candidate, will nonetheless say that if you really are so frightened of the consequences of Trump, if you really believe he shouldn't be allowed back in power again, then isn't it almost your civic duty to vote for Kamala Harris, even if you're holding your nose when you do it?
Absolutely not. I could vote for a third party candidate. Your civic duty, especially as an African American, is to go vote. The fact is that a group of people a long time ago fought very hard for my right to even have a voice. Who I'm supposed to vote for, right? Now, that should be a freedom that's still allowed.
Right. Let me ask you both a final question. Do you have a message for the political parties about the kind of choices that you've been given?
It just galls me that this is the best we can do. If we were ever going to post a third party candidate, this would have been the year, and it didn't happen.
That's right.
I agree with Cameron that, you know, I will vote. I'm not going to sit home, even though that's what I'd like to do.
One of the things that it feels like is that we're living in a post-truth era, in which the value of shame has been lost, the value of objective truth has been lost. And in the process, we have lost what used to make elections really, really important to the voters, which was policy. And it was amazing to watch the vice presidential debate reaction, just because it was civil. So my message is, hey, let's treat the American people like they are the people of old, that are capable of doing great things, that they are capable of being informed and making informed decisions. And in doing so, issue policies that actually go forth in a way, in a bold leadership vision, to take America into the next millennium. A person who is a father like me wants to know that there's a chance America could be better for my children than it has been for me. And absent real dialogue and real actual leadership, all we have gotten is feckless attempts to earn our nomination through smearing attacks. My concern is that the legacy of Donald Trump will be that we have stopped having civil discussion and we have turned into Facebook politics. And that's not the way that any country is going to survive.
Cameron Llewellyn and Lynn Kelleher talking to me, Sean Lay, on NewsHour from the BBC World Service. Thanks very much for your company.
If you're hearing this, you're probably already listening to BBC's award-winning news podcasts. But did you know that you can listen to them without ads? Get current affairs podcasts like Global News, Americast, and The Global Story, plus other great BBC podcasts from history to comedy to true crime, all ad-free. Simply subscribe to BBC Podcast Premium on Apple Podcasts or listen to Amazon Music with a Prime membership. Spend less time on ads and more time with BBC Podcasts.